Lambert here, your host for Mac in the Movies. Well, we made it. Today is the last episode of our journey through the first volume of the Grindhouse Experience from Fortune 5 DVD. It's been interesting with both ups and downs. There have been some really good movies, and there have been a few stinkers as well. For the final batch of double features, we have two horror films and two erotic films. On the horror front, we have The Children and Demon Witch Child. The erotic selections featured include High School Hitchhikers and Carry On Emmanuel. I do have a post-amble and a preview for the next few episodes of the podcast. For the post-amble, I'll be touching on everything from the recent success of Venom and why it's a bad thing for the future of Spider-Man in the MCU. The Mads are back with Traceable U and Frank Caniff. The recent Guardian article by Eleanor Robertson and how she doesn't want to be good at video games, more ridiculous Star Wars news, the recent footage of Fallout 76 and why Bethesda just doesn't understand multiplayer. There's also the cancellation of Iron Fist and why that show was pretty much doomed to begin with. But without further ado, let's get into the movies. Chemical plant workers notice high pressure in the pipeline at the Yankee Power nuclear generating facility, but they ignore it because they know their bosses wouldn't offer the OT to fix it. Unfortunately, the pressure gives way and a cloud of chemical gas makes its way across Raven's back. A school bus full of children goes through the cloud. Moments later, the local sheriff comes across the bus to find both the driver and children are missing. The sheriff orders a roadblock out of fear that the children were kidnapped. Other locals participate in the search. One of the civilians helping the sheriff finds one of the children in the cemetery. She goes to hug the child, only to be burned to death in the child's embrace. Over the course of the day, the children are attacking their parents and other citizens of Ravensback. Meanwhile, the chemical cloud is making its way to other towns in the area, affecting the children. The buildup of the parents finally defending themselves is well-paced. It's not until an hour into the film when the parents fight for themselves. And there is the conflict between the lead parents, John and Kathy. John knows they need to kill the children to save themselves, but Kathy's maternal instincts drive her to want to protect the children. The Children represents one of the better evil kid horror movies. You have the big titles like The Village of the Damned and The Bad Seed. There's the understated example of the Spanish horror film, Who Could Kill a Child? And then you have Troma's release, Beware, Children at Play. I would rate The Children at being at the same level as Who Could Kill a Child. Interestingly enough, Troma distributed The Children under their label. 42nd Street audiences would have appreciated the film for its then-extreme violence. Seeing children murdered in such a fashion would have raised eyebrows and put butts in seats. They would have loved this film. Having the composer of the then-recent Friday the 13th would have been a key selling point as well. The film does feature moments of strong violence against children. One of them is blasted with a shotgun on a staircase and one of the most impressive child stunts in the film. To defeat the children, one needs to chop off both of their hands. And this is discovered when one of the parents uses a replica katana in defense. The fact that these children are zombie-like helps with providing some emotional distance. Killing these children doesn't come off as being in bad taste as it does in Beware, Children at Play. One part of the film I found perplexing is that once the bus goes through the cloud, the children immediately become evil. they are quick to murder their parents with extreme malice. There was potential in the idea of these children still maintaining a sense of innocence. There could have been a scene where one of the children sees their parents and they rush to them out of fear and a need for security. They hug their parents only for the child to kill them. We see the child struggling to deal with their current condition and gradually over the course of the film descend into a zombie-like state. There is a deadite moment in the film. What do I mean by deadite moment? Well, deadites are the monsters associated with the Evil Dead series. One of the characteristics of a deadite is to revert back to human form to distract the person about to kill them, to mess with their head. In the children, one of the zombie kiddos calls out to her father while the other children cower in fear for their impending demise. For a moment, the father hesitates, but proceeds to kill them. Off camera, of course. The film does an okay job of sympathizing with the plight of the parents having to kill their own children, but the children are reduced to monsters too quickly for the emotional impact to reach full potency. There is one element of the film that is quite progressive for the time. One of the children has lesbian parents. You have two women who care for the child and show affection on camera, and the film doesn't need to hit us over the head with them being a same-sex couple. We don't need to be constantly reminded of them being lesbians. The film shows us that they're lesbians and trusts the audience is smart enough to come to that conclusion themselves. This is not a difficult concept to grasp and an easy way to show LGBT inclusivity in film. The children has its share of creepy moments. There's a nice scene where the children are seen through a store window, a light shining on them from below, accenting their creepy smiles. There's another moment where the children gather outside of a barn and turn in unison towards a house where their parents are hiding. Director Max Kalmanowicz didn't do a lot as a director, but made a name for himself in sound departments for TV programs. His big credits include Flight of the Conchords and The Sopranos. Not too shabby. While the film is shot in a very straightforward manner, there is one sequence of shots that just shows brilliance. Pairing the editing of Nikki Westling and cinematographer Barry Abrams creates a visual audio dichotomy. Near the end of the film, Kathy is giving birth. We hear the audio of her giving birth. All the while, the camera pans over the dead bodies of both the children and the adults. Here is a quiet, calming moment of life being born in the midst of death. The music was composed by Harry Manfredini, who did all but one of the 10 main entries of the Friday the 13th series. If the music score for the children sounds familiar to that of the original Friday the 13th, it's due to both films coming out in the same year, within a month of each other, and Manfredini doing both scores. I believe Friday the 13th came out on May 9th of 1980, and The Children came out just a little over a month on June 13th of that year. Here's a side-by-side of the scores. I'll play a little bit of Friday the 13th, and then I'll play a little bit of the score from The Children. The cast does a fine job with taking the material seriously, but there are three standouts. There is the duo of Hank and Frank, respectively played by Edward Terry and Peter Maloney. While that may be the names of the characters, I prefer to call them Denim and Plaid. In fact, I want a Denim and Plaid spin-off movie. Maloney might be recognizable to horror fans from his appearances in John Carpenter's The Thing and Michael Mann's Manhunter. Martin Brennan plays Sanford Butter Jones. His role is inconsequential, but when we first meet him, I immediately endear to him. Between his egotistical persona and him fiddling with the power windows, He's probably one of my favorite bit part characters. He's certainly the best I've seen since Steve from Raw Force. The Children is an enjoyable horror film that is simple. Zombie radioactive children and the parents that have to kill them. You can find the full movie on YouTube. An infant is abducted from its crib. Not long after, a chalice is stolen from a church. An old witch is suspected of committing both crimes. But before the police can find either the child or the chalice, the witch jumps out of a window, killing herself. While the witch is apparently dead, her spirit makes its way to possess Susan, the 10-year-old child of a police investigator. Through the child, the witch terrorizes the family of the girl, as well as those who previously tried to stop her. Through the child, the witch plans to bring back her dark lord to Earth. Demon Witch Child is the kind of movie that makes exploring these box sets exciting. When I started the movie, I had no idea what I was getting into other than that it was a horror movie. But by the time the film ended, I couldn't have been happier to find out about this obscure gem. Demon Witch Child might be one of my favorites of the box set. Where does it rank? Well, keep listening to find out. Demon Witch Child was written and directed by Armando de Osorio. De Osorio is the man behind the revered Blind Dead series that were a cornerstone of Spanish horror in the early 1970s. Spain enjoyed a brief moment of prominence in horror thanks to films like Who Could Kill a Child, Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, and The Strange Vice of Miss Ward. On paper, Demon Witch Child comes off as a ripoff of the horror classic The Exorcist, but that doesn't negate the fact that this film is a great viewing experience and a solid horror film in its own right. Also, to the film's credit, the notion of a government official's child being a spawn of evil is frequently linked to The Omen, yet Demon Witch Child came out a year before The Omen. Something to consider. Much like with The Children, the grindhouse crowd would have loved Demon Witch Child. The foul language coming from a child, the implied graphic violence, the in-camera effects would have made this a beloved 42nd Street entry. Unlike American films and similar to Italian films, the Spanish would go the extra mile to use violence you wouldn't see in a lot of mainstream horror films for the time. I appreciate that the worst violence in the film happens off-screen. The film gives you A and B and lets your mind fill in the C. Two examples. For the first one, there is a scene sacrificing an infant. We see the sacrificial blade and we see the baby. The possessed Susan stabs the knife downward towards the baby. The penetration of the blade happens off camera and we see the baby's blood fill the stolen chalice. The big scene, the one that I still think of days after seeing it, is a superb exercise in less is more. Susan strangles a man who is romantically linked to her caregiver. After Susan kills him, she unzips the guy's pants on camera. She compliments how the guy is well endowed, then pulls out a penknife. Here we have another A and B situation. We see one part of the zipping of the pants. We see her pulling out the knife. Then I guess you could say the C stands for cutting because that's exactly what she's doing and the camera doesn't show us. Susan proceeds to gift wrap the organ and give it to her caregiver, who was in love with the guy that the possessed Susan castrated post-mortem. Knowing that relationship adds a lot to the suspense and anticipation of Susan getting this horrible surprise to her caregiver. There was one moment that nearly made me fall off my couch. The sequence is thanks to both cinematographer Vicente Minella and editor Pedro Del Rey. Susan is putting on the cursed necklace that empowers the witch possessing her. Thanks to trick editing and photography, Susan's upper half appear above her waist, and the lower half below her waist are facing opposite directions. From the waist up, she's looking away from the camera. From the waist down, she's facing the camera. This moment just blew my mind, and just shows the ingenuity of these filmmakers. And not a single computer was used to compose the effect. It was all in camera and post-production. The good old days. The music by Victor and Diego is fantastic. It's atmospheric and creates an audio picture that sets the tone just right for the film. Their music predates Goblin's work for Argento's Deep Red. There were cues that would foreshadow Goblin's work for Suspiria. The duo only worked on three films, which is a shame because the work they do here is right up there with longer-lasting acts like Goblin, Fabio Frizzi, and Oliver Onions. Salgado as Susan steals the film. She plays the dichotomy of the little innocent girl and the evil old witch nicely. We see her enough as the young girl to sympathize with her when she's possessed and the horrible acts she commits under the spell of the witch. Her casting was clever on the part of De Osorio. Salgado was the Spanish dubbing actress for Reagan from The Exorcist in foreign territories. Having her as the possessed little girl just makes sense. Fans of the Blind Dead series will recognize both Lone Fleming and Fernando Sancho. Sancho was the corrupt mayor in Return of the Blind Dead, which was the second part in the series. Sancho unfortunately passed away in 1990. Fleming was in the first two films of the series and is still acting to this day, often taking parts in roles in and out of the horror genre. Demon Witch Child was a wonderful surprise to come out of this collection. While not available on YouTube, DVDs can be found on Amazon as well as the indie site Twisted Danger. I reached out to them and was informed that they offer region-free DVDs. Their selections are just full of good-looking stuff, including a few titles from this box set, including Demon Witch Child, as well as the Blaxploitation Italian Cinema Mix, Three Tough Guys with Isaac Hayes and Fred the Hammer Williamson. This movie can easily be found for a cheap price. I believe it's $4.99 in British pounds, which translates to around $10 American, so that's still a really good price for these movies.
It's time for you to know that Jackie and I have, let's say, a very intimate relationship. We like each other very much, and we act unblushingly when we're together.
Jackie and Monica are two girls who love to get into mischief, but they manage to get themselves into a situation that might be too much for them. While hiking, they come across a villa that is apparently abandoned. Thinking they're alone, they engage in some sensual activity. Unbeknownst to them, the villa is a hideout for a thief, Fred. He is currently in hiding after pulling off a job for Beatrice, a crime boss with a mean streak and kind of has the hots for Fred. Fred hid the loot from his robbery in the villa. Soon, the girls meet with Fred, and as you would expect, a threesome follows. Beatrice arrives to pick up the loot shortly after the girls leave. Fred opens the safe, only to find the loot is missing. Panicked, Fred blames the girls. Beatrice sends Fred and her bodyguard to get them and bring them back to the house for interrogation. Jackie is tortured by Fred under the supervision of Beatrice. Meanwhile, Monica seduces Beatrice's bodyguard. After knocking them out with a flower vase, she escapes and goes to the police. Monica comes back with a detective and his petite female secretary. What follows is a comedic, harmless, madcap back and forth between the heroes and the villains. High School Hitchhikers was the toe-dipping into erotica for French director Jean Rollin. Before that, Rollin specialized in horror films with erotic elements. With High School Hitchhikers, Rollin makes a full-fledged softcore erotic film. This film is from a time when pornography wasn't sexually aggressive or treating the people involved like pieces of meat. There was a delicateness to handling the erotic elements. When I say softcore, I mean late-night Cinemax softcore. Probably even softer than Cinemax. Fred gets all the action in the film, but his pants are still on during the love sequences. You can only see the gals get nude, and for the male audiences of the Grindhouse theaters, that was all they needed. The film clocks in at only 1 hour and 7 minutes, which was great since it allowed for a lot of screens for theaters to make money with, and it's the shortest film on this collection. If there was one problem with the film, it's the near-end film introduction of a character credited on IMDb as Man in the Red Turtleneck, who was actually played by the director Jean Rollin. The film shows this character was the one having stolen the loot from under Fred at the villa. This is almost as bad as the introduction of Mrs. Voorhees in the original Friday the 13th in the last 20 minutes of that film. Never was this character established, and to throw him in at the very end is just lazy writing. And yes, I'm complaining about a plot hole that matters. So Patrick Willems, you can kiss my ass. One other gripe I have is the presence of narration carrying the story, including in the audience. Natalie Perret wrote the script. There is probably about as much actual dialogue in this film that you could fit in a post-it note. This is a film that could easily have worked without the narration. The audience was smart enough to figure out what's happening with the visuals alone. Director Jean Rollin made a nice niche for himself making erotic horror films. Occasionally, he fully went into horror. Grapes of Death and Zombie Lake immediately come to mind. I love the music from this film. Pierre Raff did an excellent job mixing genres together. You have the Baroque piece played at the beginning of this segment. You have the Birdman-esque drum solo play that goes on during the shootout. My favorite has to be the main title piece, which has a great acoustic guitar rhythm with some brass providing the melody, and you have a flute serving as the bridge. Ladies in the film bear their carnal assets. Joelle Correr plays the brunette Monica. Gilda Arancio is the blonde Jackie. Renee Theron is the petite secretary of the detective. To say this film is high school hitchhikers would be misleading, since these gals are probably well over the age of 18, but the title plays into the titillation. Whether you like busty gals or prefer petite body types, the female cast will catch your eye. Willie Brack plays Fred the thief. He looks rugged with a scar on his face. He managed to make a nice career for himself as a heavy in French erotica. If you're looking for a film that goes back to a simpler time for pornography, then High School Hitchhikers would be worth your time. DVDs are surprisingly easy to find, whether it's Blu-ray or regular DVD. There's a woman in my life who doesn't care for a thing. She don't want to go out dancing, she just loves to stay in. She just cares about good love and never needs. Emmanuelle Prévert is the wife of French ambassador Emile Prévert. After a parachuting accident kills his libido, Emmanuelle has taken an exhibitionist hobby to sleep with any man she runs into. Whether it's on a plane or at a diplomat's dinner or in the locker room of the local football team, she can't keep herself in control of her urges. One of the men she has a tryst with, Theodore Valentine, mistakes her advances for interest in him. He fails to realize she's already married. She fails to remember who he actually is. Carry On, Emmanuel is the 30th film in the Carry On series that dates all the way back to 1958. The Carry On series takes its comedic nature from the seaside postcards popular in Britain in the 1890s. These postcards were cheeky in nature with innuendo humor. This type of humor and play with language was a hallmark of the Carry On series.
Oh, Emmanuel! I hope you're going to wear something under that dress.
Oh, yes.
Chanel number 5.
No, no, tonight you must be respectable. You must be on your best behavior. Everything you say and do will reflect on our beloved republic.
But this is the latest from Paris. It shows style.
It shows more than that. It shows everything you've got. Well, almost everything.
What is so terrible about that?
It's not nice. How would you like it if men were to walk about in see-through trousers?
Oh, I would like this very much. Oh. There is nothing wrong with a human body.
There is no need to flash it all over the place.
I think we should all go around without any clothes on. We'd all be much healthier.
We'd all be in bed with the flu.
Nudity is perfectly natural.
No, no, even Adam and Eve had a fig leaf.
Don't confuse this film with the plethora of Emmanuel films. There's the original series of films with Sylvia Crystal. Then there's the different Skinemax series with Krista Allen, Holly Sampson. There's the Italian Black Emmanuel films with Laura Gemser. Carry On Emmanuel is a lighthearted parody of these films from the Carry On comedic troupe. Why do I know about these films? Well, I am a guy after all. This film, compared to the other Emmanuel entries, they're literally PG-13. The film's rating in Britain by the British Board of Film Censors was AA, which equates to a PG-13 rating in the American system. You will see some flesh, but nothing shocking or more than you would see in an episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Yes, folks, there actually was some nudity on that show. The people in front and behind the camera were veterans of the group. Director Gerald Thomas directed all 30 of the films in the Carry On series. Lead actor Kenneth Williams starred in 26 of the 30, and he has his moments as Emile Prevert. Lead actress Susan Daniel plays up the erotic nature of the Emmanuel character. Danielle was in Flash Gordon, as well as appeared on the Tom Baker era of Doctor Who for the Destiny of the Daleks storyline. It has its amusing moments, filled with clever wordplay and some harmless display of Susan Daniel's assets. It's not easy to find, but if you can find it, it's not a bad start if you're new to the Carry On series. And that's it. We're done. That's it for the first volume of the Grindhouse Experience from Fortune 5 DVD. It was a long, strange trip. There was a nice balance of good and bad. Now for the final ranking of films from dead last to top of the class. At number 20, we have Tortured Angels, which is total crap. Number 19, we have Women's Camp 119, which is total Nazi crap. Number 18, Mandinga, total racist crap. Number 17, The Bounty Man, a bland, made-for-TV movie that has no place in a grindhouse theater. Number 16, Earthquake 7.9, a Japanese disaster film that has its heart in the right place. Number 15, Savage Man, Savage Beast, an interesting Mondo documentary. Number 14, Kung Fu Punch of Death, Chop Saki with its share of moments. Number 13, Carry On Emmanuel, a witty British comedy with some titillation. Number 12, The Violent Professionals, a decent entry in the Polizio Teschi genre. Number 11, The Children, an above-par evil children horror film. Number 10, Go Kill and Come Back, a.k.a. Any Gun Can Play, a great early directorial effort by Enzo G. Castellari. Number 9, High School Hitchhikers, an amusing softcore romp with a great music score by Pierre Raff. Number 8, The Executioner Part 2, a vigilante movie that is more enjoyable than it has any right to be. Number 7, The Poseidon Explosion, a well-made, tense survival drama. Number 6, Three Tough Guys, Polizio Teschi meets blaxploitation with a great score by Isaac Hayes. Number 5, Raw Force, a funny, action-packed martial arts film. Number 4, Confessions of a Police Captain, a film too good to be included in a grindhouse collection. Number 3, Return of the Tiger, Paul L. Smith versus Bruce Lai is essentially Bud Spencer versus Bruce Lee, and it's awesome. Number 2, Demon Witch Child, a fantastic Spanish knockoff of The Exorcist from the master behind the Blind Dead series. And still number 1, Mean Frank and Crazy Tony, an excellent buddy film with two great leads in Lee Van Cleef and Tony Lobianco. You have the eye-catching Edwidge Fennec and a great score by Riz Ortholani. Yes, folks, I liked Demon Witch Child that much. There is a Volume 2 that I actually have, but I'm going to hold off on that one for a good while. I'm probably going to wait until next summer to explore that box set. While I'm on the topic of the show, I'm going to go ahead and lay out the schedule for the remainder of the year. For Halloween, I'm going to try, and emphasis on try, to have the next episode ready by Halloween, which falls on Wednesday, October 31st. That episode will be dedicated to my favorite horror movie composer, Goblin. For November 16th, I'll be covering some underrated and forgotten comedies. For November 30th, I'll be doing an episode on select films of the duo Bud Spencer and Terrence Hill. December 14th, I'll be covering innovative movies in the zombie subgenre, The Trendsetters and The Game Changers of the Living Dead. To end 2018, I'll be doing a top 10 of my favorite films that I looked at from making the movies, and some alternative Christmas movies for those who are just sick and tired of the milquetoast offerings like A Christmas Story and It's a Wonderful Life. That episode will be up by the 24th as an early Christmas present to all you wonderful people. All right, let's get into some postamble. First, I wanted to talk about the success of Venom and why it's not a good thing for the future of Spider-Man in the MCU. Venom has producers who are the worst people to reward with box office success. These individuals include the likes of Amy Pascal, Tom Rothman, and Avi Arad. Pascal and Rothman, I went on a diatribe over with in my Ghostbusters episode. If you missed out on that, go ahead and give that one a listen. I have more to say about Pascal, but that will be in due time. I already tore them a new one over their poor decisions that ruined or stalled various films over the past decade. Avi Arad is a special case. He started out for a long time on the right foot with comic fans. He produced the animated shows for both X-Men and Spider-Man. He was an executive producer for Blade, which helped bring comic book movies back into fashion after the disaster that was Batman and Robin. He gave way for Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy, the live-action X-Men films, the Thomas Jane Punisher film. Where he took a wrong turn was twisting Sam Raimi's arm to include Venom in Spider-Man 3. Up to that point, Arad left Raimi to his own devices. Raimi grew up with the old-school Spidey villains like Green Goblin, Dr. Octopus, and Sandman. Raimi had no interest or emotional investment with the character of Venom. But Arad kept pressuring Raimi to include Venom to the point where Raimi shoved Venom into the film's script, much to the detriment of Raimi, the film, and the character of Venom. In fact, it hurt it so much that Spider-Man was rebooted 5 years later with The Amazing Spider-Man. Arad and MCU mastermind Kevin Feige have tension between them because of their differing visions for Marvel characters. This will only embolden Sony not to renew their current deal with Marvel Studios. And they had a nice thing going, too. Marvel Studios made Spider-Man Homecoming, while Sony kept all the money of the box office as the distributor. Sony didn't have to do anything. They could just literally sit there and let the money come in. But in their lack of wisdom, they decided that they were going to make a Spider-Man cinematic universe without Spider-Man. A character whose origin is intertwined with Spider-Man, brought to the screen without the symbiote latching onto Peter Parker first. And by the grace of God and the narrow-visioned fandom of the character, the film made a lot of money that first weekend and then experienced a modest drop in box office on the second weekend, a drop of 55%. Grace Randolph, I love ya. You've got a great mind for the movie business, but I had to call you out on praising Venom for not dropping too badly on the second weekend. According to your movie math segment, you said that Venom can still be considered a success if it doesn't drop 60% or more. If the film drops 60% or more, it would be deemed a disappointment and something for Sony to not talk about. These were your words. The stopping point of the second weekend drop of box office for Venom was 55%, and we have your established point of disappointment for 60%. This isn't something for Sony to be celebrating with bravado. They just barely missed that fail point. Imagine you're a parent, and your kid comes home from a major exam. They walk into the house, strutting around like they're Vince McMahon. They've got their chest puffed out. They're walking like they're hot stuff. You see this, and they think they must have got a 90 or 100 on the exam. Then they tell you they got a 70. and the fail grade is a 65. Any parent with common sense would slap the back of the head of that kid. They just barely dodged the bullet. Same with Venom dropping 55% instead of 60%. Sony just barely avoided mucking this up. This hair's breadth success should be a red flag to Sony to leave the superhero cinematic universe stuff to the people who know what they're doing. Basically anybody but Sony. And now because Venom fans were so desperate for this dated character to be on screen, they thought it was good judgment to give Sony this much power and give them the false confidence to not likely renew their deal with Marvel. Thanks a lot. We'll know who to blame when Sony inevitably screws up for a third time and they have to reboot Spider-Man. Again. Here's a little history lesson for you. After the release of Spider-Man 2 in 2014, Kevin Feige had a lunch meeting with Amy Pascal. During this meeting, Feige proposed to Pascal to include a new Spider-Man film with Marvel producing. In response, Pascal threw a sandwich at Feige. Fast forward a few months later, and Amazing Spider-Man 2 was deemed a box office disappointment. Pascal then begged Feige to take the creative reins of Spider-Man. I think Feige is too nice of a guy for this business. If that was me, if Pascal threw a sandwich at me, then turned around and begged me to save Spider-Man for them, here would be my response. This is before the 20th Century Fox purchase by Disney, so my path would still be plausible for that year of 2014. Here's my course of action. I would have mailed her a blank check with a note. The note would say, "This check will either purchase the rights of Spider-Man and all related characters, reverting back to Marvel Studios, or this check will purchase the Sony movie division and we will replace you with people we find more agreeable." I haven't seen Venom yet because I'll spend my money on a movie more deserving of it, but I did catch the stinger at the end on YouTube. Seeing Woody Harrelson in a bad Ronald McDonald wig doesn't fill me with confidence, Sony. Then he opened his mouth. He said, "When I get out of here, and I will, there's gonna be carnage." Can I sue Sony for giving me a concussion from hitting me over the head with their lack of subtlety? Oh, and sorry not sorry for spoiling the stinger at the end of the film. I recently had the pleasure of seeing The Mads Are Back with Mystery Science Theater 3000's Trace Beaulieu and Frank Kniff. With all due respect to Riff Trax and the heavily watered-down MST3K revival, this is my favorite of the MST3K spinoffs. Trace was probably my favorite member of the cast. I really enjoyed his Groucho Marx-esque delivery. Of all the people I've met, my interaction with him might be my favorite of all time. I complimented him on his work on the indie sci-fi drama Trip to Sane. I don't know what kind of response I was actually expecting back, maybe like, oh, thank you, or I appreciate that. No, his response was, "Oh, so you're the one guy who saw that movie. That was the last thing I expected to hear." I appreciate that the Mads aren't afraid to drop F-bombs while riffing on the movie. They don't handle these movies with kids' gloves. The gloves come off with Trace and Frank, and I appreciate that about them. Let's see what's next. Oh, yeah. Eleanor Robertson, a writer for The Guardian, showed that mainstream journalists who write about video games are just as inept at playing video games as video game journalists. She wrote the article, "I don't want to get good at gaming. I want to escape the relentless pressure to improve myself." In other words, she sucks at playing video games, she's always sucked at playing video games, and she will forever suck at playing video games. And she demands that video games cater to her degree of suckitude. Don't worry, Eleanor, there are plenty of walking simulators for you to play while us skilled gamers enjoy our more challenging titles. And we have more Star Wars news. Oscar Isaac let it out recently that Star Wars Episode 9 is going to have more improvised scenes. Because when I think of improv, yeah, I think of Star Wars. Is Lucasfilm purposely trying to make my prediction of a $300 million box office drop for episode 9 come true? Are they just running this film into the ground so they can focus on TV shows that are in the works instead? Recent footage of the upcoming Fallout 76 made its way to the internet, and yeah, it's exactly as I feared. It's trying to be an MMO, much like Elder Scrolls Online, and this is the type of multiplayer that I, and likely others, didn't want with our open-world games. We just wanted to explore the worlds of the Boston Wasteland or Skyrim with our friends, much like the multiplayer of Monster Hunter. Just me and two or three other people exploring the dungeons or the vaults, taking down dragons or super mutant behemoths. We don't want to play with a bunch of strangers, just a few of our close-knit gamer friends. Why is this so difficult to grasp, Bethesda? And one last note of the post-amble, Iron Fist on Netflix was canceled. When Finn Jones was announced to play Danny Rand, this was back at least a good, 2 years ago, I want to say? Yeah, 2 years ago about. The regressive blogosphere just went insane and wondered why an Asian wasn't playing Iron Fist. You know, ignoring the fact that Rand was a white character in the comic. Then in season 2, the show ended with Colleen getting the power of the Iron Fist, to the applause of the regressives. Netflix Marvel succumbed to the whines of the identitarian politics blogosphere, and the show got canceled. Go figure. Oh, and I guess apparently now only Asians can do martial arts? Well, I guess somebody better go tell Chuck Norris, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Gary Daniels, Ray Park, Cynthia Rothrock, Keanu Reeves, Michael Jai White, Wesley Snipes, Scott Atkins, David Carradine. Oh, wait, never mind about David Carradine. Forget that one. Somebody better go tell them that they can no longer do martial arts. Honestly, Finn Jones as Danny Rand was at his best in his one episode appearance of season 2 of Luke Cage. They had the character perfect there. He no longer had a stick up his ass. Hopefully this means that season 3 of Luke Cage will just be heroes for hire, and Rand can be handled by the Luke Cage writers, who clearly know what they're doing. And that's it for this episode of Making the Movies. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this content, feel free to follow the show on the platform of your choice. iTunes, Podomatic, Google Play, Spotify. I'm on social media. I have links to my Facebook and Twitter in the description. If you would like to see this program grow, feel free to be a regular donor to my Patreon or a one-time donation through PayPal. Next time, I will be looking at the horror movie composer band, Goblin, and that will drop on Halloween Day, which is Wednesday the 31st. Until then, I'm Mackenzie Lambert with Mac and the Movies. Take care, folks.